this committee meeting to order. Since we got the budget, through the budget yesterday without any kind of a major hassle, we don't have much left to do today, I don't think. No, the clerk, please call the roll.
Representative Croft? Representative Foster? Representative Hocker?
Here.
Representative Jewell? Representative Meyer?
Here.
Representative Moses?
Here.
Representative Stevens?
Here.
Representative Stoltz?
Here.
Representative Blücher?
Here.
Representative Harris?
Here.
Representative Williams?
Here.
Okay, we have a quorum, even though we're going to just do overviews today. Before we move on into our overview section, is there anything anybody, any members would like to bring for the good of the order?
Mr. Chairman, am I expected
Representative Stoltz?
Am I expected to talk more to pick up the slack from the missing left side?
Well, yes. You are the left wing of the body today.
So,
I know you resemble that remark, but that's, yeah, you can talk all you want, and I'll recognize you whenever you raise your hand.
Okay.
You have to move in those chairs.
Okay, seeing no other constructive criticism of the chairman this morning, this afternoon, we will move rapidly into our agency overviews. And today we have Diane Behrens. Diane, you're here, I know. And you're going to give us a little overview on the Post-Secondary Education Commission. And I see we have a little packet in front of us here as well. Members should all have that.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Diane Behrens, and I'm the Executive Director of the Alaska Commission on Post-Secondary Education and the Executive Officer of the Alaska Student Loan Corporation. I'd like to thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Harris, Mr. Chair, Representative Williams, and the other members of the body for this opportunity to speak about the service mission of our agency. Before you in your packet, there's a summary overview. Beginning with the mission of the commission, the Alaska Commission and its financial partner, the Alaska Student Loan Corporation, serve Alaska by supporting the development of economically viable lifelong learners and citizens by providing educational financial assistance to post-secondary students and their families and authorizing the operation of post-secondary institutions in Alaska. We serve and support this mission by providing financial aid for post-secondary education, developing and delivering financial aid planning tools for Alaskans and their families, developing and implementing strategies to increase access and participation of Alaskans in post-secondary education, promoting Alaska post-secondary education institutions, providing quality standards for post-secondary institutions and training opportunities in the state, and responding to emerging needs for administering education financial assistance and access programs and services. Currently, the Alaska Commission on Post-Secondary Education offers educational access assistance. We originate and service Alaska Advantage loans. This includes, beginning in 2002-2003, federal Title IV loans that are underwritten by the federal government and the Alaska Supplemental Education, which Alaskans use in combination with the federal aid to meet their education needs. In addition, we administer some specialized education loan programs. Those include the teacher education loans and family education loans to family members borrowing on behalf of their family members. We also originate and service memorial education loans. These are very small loans that are funded outside the corporation assets and target specific areas. The prime example currently is the Win Brindle Memorial Education Loan Program, which is available to residents attending in fisheries-related programs. We also, on behalf of the Department of Education and Early Development, disperse grants to low-income students through the state's participation in the federal Gear Up program, and we coordinate participation in the WICHE Student Exchange Program, as well as the WAMI Graduate Medical Education Programs. In the last year, we've expanded our services to include more outreach programs. You may be aware that Alaska has the lowest college attendance of college-age students in the nation. Typically, less than one in four Alaskan that is college-age is actually going on to college. The commission believes this is a serious issue for the state, both in terms of the individuals who are missing out on an opportunity to use post-secondary education to personally benefit economically, but also to the state as a whole because of the increasing need for an educated workforce to provide supply for a growing state economy. We also protect the education consumer by monitoring advertising that schools do in the state, responding to public complaints in the event that a need for a refund or a teach-out of a student is required in the event of a school closure. We supervise those activities. And as I indicated, we're trying to increase the college-going rate of Alaskans, which we believe is basically due to a lack of information. We certainly provide the types of programs that would allow an informed consumer to decide to invest in themselves. We simply believe that Alaskans are either unaware of the process for gaining that financial assistance or the importance to them of going on to post-secondary training of some kind. And so we have expanded our activities. This year we actually bought a mobile unit to put our Anchorage-based staff out into the road system to visit high schools. We hope to eventually get to junior high students. We believe that that a decision at some level is made either within a family or within a student's goal setting at a very early age as to whether or not their college material or that post-secondary education is required for them to benefit. And we believe that we really need to get to students at the sixth grade, to get to their families when the students are at the sixth grade, and create a united commitment within the family to go on to post-secondary education that requires not only information about financial planning, but academic planning, so that students that do pursue post-secondary education are prepared to succeed rather than to fail in that effort and have the debt associated with that, but not the credentials in which to repay the debt. Our organizational structure is a 14-member body. The commission is statutorily authorized, and the membership is set out in AS 1442-015. I have attached as the last page in the handout a list of the current incumbent members and what element or group in post-secondary education that they represent. The commission staff, which totals 104 authorized positions, are organized in 5 divisions. They're managed and supported by a 7-member professional team. The information services director, our finance officer, and internal auditor, director of operations and outreach, compliance services, and personnel. Each of these report directly to the executive director. We operate an operations center located here in Juneau, and our marketing, outreach, institutional compliance, and information technology unit is based in our Anchorage office. The Alaska Student Loan Corporation is comprised of a 5-member board, all of which are appointed by the governor. 3 of them are cabinet members, the commissioners of revenue, community and economic development, and administration, as well as 2 public members appointed from the commission to also serve on the corporation. The staff of the commission is the staff of the corporation. The corporation's duties really are threefold. We borrow money to finance the programs available to Alaskans. We invest the money as required by the covenants of those financing. And we enter into agreements, and the corporation enters into agreement with ACPE to actually administer the loan fund. As many of you are aware, the Alaska Advantage Loan Program is sort of the new, evolved, and what we believe to be substantially improved service that we began offering Alaskans just last year. After a period of several years from the late 1980s to the mid-1990s, during which the corporation experienced precarious financial standing, significant improvements to the loan program and the servicing of the portfolio have resulted in a positive financial impact for the corporation. Since 1995, when the first of many program changes were made by the legislature, the corporation has continued to progress toward creating a strong financial foundation. This is evidenced by some of our current statistics. Our program cohort default rate has dropped from 17%, which was reported with the 1996 cohort, to a rate of 4.6% with the latest 2001 cohort rate numbers. Program expenses, including loan losses, have declined by $8.2 million from FY95 to FY2002, and the cumulative fund deficit, which peaked at $50 million in 1997, was eliminated by the end of fiscal year 2002. Included in the document are a number of program highlights, and rather than go over those in detail, I think I'll skip to page 4 with the corporation objectives. If any of you have any interest in having me revisit some of what we've done to accomplish that change, I would be happy to do so. The corporation objectives are pretty straightforward. The corporation wishes to ensure the ongoing fiscal stability and credit standing of the corporation, which is currently a AA1, continue to offer low interest rates to ensure affordable education to new customers, continue to identify ways to translate financial stability into cost savings for existing and past customers who continue to repay on their loans, and to provide an annual payment to the state as a return of its original capital contribution of $3.6 million of loan assets in 1987. We continue to focus on identifying changes and implementing changes to keep us in this positive momentum direction. Looking at the actual activities of the agency's divisions, our student loan operations unit is targeted at servicing the outstanding loan portfolio, the objective of which is to maximize repayment to the student loan fund and to protect the financial integrity of the corporation. We're currently, some of you may be aware, some of you more aware than others if you have children borrowing from the program, that this year with the implementation of the Alaska Advantage program, we've switched to a variable loan product, which the combination of current low financing rates as well as the financial improvement to the corporation have allowed us to make a loan going out the door with an interest rate of less than 4%. The corporation has approved additional benefits to accrue to participants if they qualify it. For instance, if they attend a school in Alaska, their rate is discounted. If they decide to repay their loan using a cost-effective manner, such as an electronic pay program, there's a discount to their interest rate there. So clearly this has translated, if you will, into significant benefits for the state. The student loan operations is primarily focused on keeping costs as low as possible. Within that overall division, we have information support services. Those are our IT staff, the finance unit, which tracks all of the payments, does the financial reporting, oversees funds investment, and prepares the annual agency operating capital and lending budgets. Within our student financial aid area, we've got a loan servicing unit, a customer service unit, administrative services, and a collections unit. The collection unit and customer service units are the areas where we probably have our largest staffing pools. We move those staffs or allocate them based on what's happening in our loan portfolio, whether we have more loans going out the door, whether we have more loans in repayment, or we see a migration of loans or an increase or concern about delinquency. So through cross-training those staff, we're able to shift them around as needs require. The program administration component, well, let me back up. The one new area, which I've already touched on, is outreach. And the outreach unit is tasked with disseminating education planning information, getting in contact, establishing networks for students, parents, high school counselors, financial aid officers, and the general public. In the program administration unit, primarily that's comprised of the executive office, the personnel office, and the compliance services section. We oversee the agency activities and are focused on ensuring that institutions that participate in our program comply with the requirements of doing so. Again, on page 7 of the outline in front of you, there is a description of the responsibilities unique to each of the offices there, and so I won't go into that in any detail. The last two programs I'd like to reference are the WICHE student exchange programs. Alaska is one of a 15-state Western regional cooperative called the Western Interstate Commission on Higher Education. The commission was created 50 years ago by the member states, And the goal of the commission is to identify ways that the states can participate in regional resource sharing. There was a recognition at that point, certainly, that these Western states had emerging and growing populations that would require higher education resources be grown rather than have states duplicate entire systems in each of the states at a cost to which some of the less populated states would find unfeasible. They developed several student exchange programs, which are the core foundation of Wichee Commission programs. Alaska participates in three of these programs, the Western Undergraduate Exchange, which is a program that allows residents of member states to attend participating schools in other member states at a discounted rate. They pay more than a resident of that state would, but substantially less than a non-resident, typically about 150% of a regular resident tuition. Alaska is both a sending and a receiving state in that program. We also participate in the Professional Student Exchange Program, which is a program which until the late 90s was actually basically grant funded. The general fund was tapped for a certain amount of funding each year that was paid on behalf of these students who were entering graduate education programs in participating schools in the West. Examples would be physical therapy, occupational therapy, medicine, veterinary medicine, and so on. But in order to offset the cost of the receiving institution, the state actually paid a per student expenditure to subsidize the in-state tuition that the students paid. When general fund...
Second, Diane. Representative Stoltz has a quick question.
Are we subsidizing training of any lawyers? Is that considered a critical state need?
Through the chair, Representative Stoltz, at one time, the Professional Student Exchange Program did support study of law. That ended in 1988.
I think Representative, now Senator Murkowski, always claimed to be part of that program.
Perhaps.
I think so.
But at this point, the structure in which Alaska participates in this particular exchange program is basically a loan program. Students that participate in that program actually incur as a loan debt the value of the support fee paid on their behalf. So it's a much smaller program than it was in prior times. And then the last program is the Western Regional Graduate Exchange Program. This is a program where institutions essentially identify sort of subspecialty graduate programs where they want to keep that program available at their institution, but because of the narrow focus of it, it's sort of undersubscribed. There isn't enough resident interest in the program, and so they put it forward to the Wichee Commission to allow them to recruit effectively across the 15 member state to attract students. I think University of Alaska Fairbanks participates in this in one of their Polar Study graduate programs. So it's that kind of niche graduate program that is involved there. And that is, Alaska is both a receiving and ascending state, meaning students from other states attend our institutions, Alaskans attend programs elsewhere. The total loan volume for the, in follow-up to Representative Stoltz's question earlier, for 2002-2003 was just over $125,000 in loans that was made to students to support their attendance at graduate programs. The last program, and I believe that the representative for Alaska for the WAMI Medical Education Program is online, Suzanne Trick, who is Anchorage-based, was unable to be here today, but wanted to make herself available for questions. But I'll just briefly describe the WAMI program. The WAMI Medical Education Program provides guaranteed access for Alaskans to a medical school. Each year, 10 spaces in each class is reserved for Alaskan students at the University of Washington School of Medicine. That program is jointly offered with the University of Alaska Anchorage, and students in their first year of study attend at the Anchorage campus. A WAMI is the acronym for Washington, Wyoming, Alaska, Montana, and Idaho, and represents an initiative of the UW's to really serve as a regional medical school rather than simply a state medical school. They believe there's a number of shared interests in these states, shared characteristics in these states in terms of public health needs, geographic nature of the states, and feel it's appropriate to try to find ways to benefit the member states' residents. So beyond the 40 students who would be in the WAMI program in any one year, there are additional benefits that accrue to the state. Some samples of those benefits are the rural, it's called the RITE program. It's the WAMI Rural Integrated Training Experience. It was developed by the WAMI program to bring students in the third year of their medical training into a rural practice setting where they spend 6 months of the year with a practitioner. One of the things that is looked at when UW and the faculty and the member states look at entering applicants is their interest in family medicine and their interest in rural medicine, because they are trying to address the shortage of doctors into those high need fields. So that's a program, that's a good example of another benefit to the state. A couple other programs I would mention is the MedCon. University of Washington School of Medicine sponsors a toll-free line for physicians in Alaska to consult. In 2002, there were 2,300 consults where Alaska docs called in and tapped into the collective expertise of UW and their staff. Also, we participate in UW's MedX program, which is a physician assistant training program that slots reserves six slots for Alaskans in that program each year. And that's a program that would allow a student to take credits that they've earned down there, transfer to the University of Alaska Anchorage, and continue their training there. So those are examples of the ways that the rural component, the western component of a regional medical school really are integrated into the mission services and programs to aid a state that is geographically large, I guess that's an understatement, but that has a serious need to address rural issues as well as urban issues. And with that, I would conclude my comments and make myself available to any questions.
Representative Meyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for the presentation. Just a couple questions about the program. The interest rates on these student loans, how are they determined? Weekly, monthly, yearly?
Yes. Through the chair, Representative Meyer, they are basically set on a formula that the federal government uses. And it's an average, it's reset once a year, but it's reset based on an averaged, I may have to turn to my finance officer and have her address you on this, because it's a resale rate, and it's the average of a resale rate for the index.
You'd like to come up to the table and
this is Sheila King, our finance officer.
Please introduce yourself for the record.
For the record, my name is Sheila King. I'm the finance officer of the Alaska Commission on Postsecondary Education. The loan rate, to address your question, Mr. Chairman, Representative Myers, through the chair, is set based on the 91-day T-bill on the last auction in May every year. And they add, we add an index to it based on the federal statutes.
Okay, thank you. If I may follow up. In fact, I'll ask you the question that my constituent was asking me. Apparently, he received a loan several years ago. It was a much higher rate, and he wants to know why he can't refinance this loan like we do with our houses and everything else.
It's an Alaska student loan, not a federal loan? Oh, did you want to address that?
Sure. Through the chair, Representative Meyer, we intend in April of this year to offer a first consolidated loan offering. There's a couple of things that it's important to understand when someone suggests that there's a direct comparison to today's loan to the loans that we made up through 2001. The loans that the commission issued prior to 2002 were fixed rate loans, and they were set based on the cost of financing for the funds that funded that loan. The other issue that we had to address was the fact there was zero interest charge while the borrower was in school, and during certain periods of deferment. So in order to calculate the actual effective interest that was being charged on that, you would have to factor in whatever the length of that interest-free period is. The rates that we're issuing today, or the loans that we're issuing today, are reset each year, and interest begins to accrue the day the funds are dispersed. So all the time the student is going to school, interest is accruing. If they choose not to pay that interest, it's capitalized and becomes part of their principal going into repayment. So it's not as black and white as it would appear. Having said that, though, clearly we do need to make some effort to to mitigate the costs that, prior past borrowers have incurred. In order to do that, we literally have to pay off the loan in the indenture in which it was, from which it was issued. And so it's a refinancing both for the borrower and for the corporation. The corporation just at a meeting yesterday approved the setting of an interest rate that is lower than the one that would otherwise apply to a consolidated loan of Alaska student loans. Current statutes indicate that we would charge the average weighted balance of the underlying loans being consolidated. No benefit to the borrower financially, perhaps a little ease of having one loan rather than several. But they approved an interest rate that would be tied to the 10-year T-bill, the last February sale.
It'll actually sell next week, the one that will set the rate.
For the 2003 consolidation offering. And so the corporation will periodically identify what amount of funds it can use to refinance these. The first issue is going to be about $40 million, and we'll start receiving applications this spring.
Okay, good. I have several other questions, Mr. Chairman.
Fire away.
Okay. Now, you had mentioned that there's different loan rates, interest rates, depending on if you go in-state versus out-of-state. Is it the same for all the out-of-state schools, or is it more if you go to Harvard versus Oregon or Washington?
Through the chair, Representative Meyer, we do not differentiate. We see it more as a benefit for a student selecting to attend in Alaska and a way for us to assist Alaska institutions in recruiting students to attend here in Alaska.
Okay, very good. Do all Alaskans get a loan if they apply or request?
Through the chair, Representative Meyer, there are certain eligibility criteria that they do need to meet, both for the federal loan and for the state loan. For example, they may have no past due child support obligations. They may not have previously defaulted on a loan to the state. With respect to the federal loan and now with the state loan, if they are subject to selective service requirements, we must have evidence that they have satisfied those requirements. But other than those types of criteria, a federal loan is an entitlement to anyone meeting just those basic, you're a citizen, you've done the right thing sort of thing. So that's available. For the Alaska Supplemental Education Loan, there is a credit review that is performed on those because they are not underwritten or otherwise guaranteed. But it's basically an absence of bad credit as opposed to a demonstration of good credit, if you will.
Okay, very good. Yeah, and most 18-year-olds probably don't have a whole lot of credit history yet. So.
No, in fact, our decline rate is on those loans was less than 7%, I would say, each year, whereas a bank typically for those sorts of loans would see a decline rate in excess of 40%.
Okay, good. And one other question for now, Mr. Chairman. The WAMI program, is there a requirement for how long the student has to live in the state of Alaska in order to qualify for the WAMI program? In other words, if they become a doctor and they come back to Alaska, do they have to stay here 5, 10 years? Or?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Meyer. There is not an obligation. However, as of 3 years ago, there is an obligation, and it's that either they return to Alaska and work for up to 4 years, or they're obligated to repay as a loan that portion of the support the state paid that was the difference between resident and non-resident. And currently the amount that would be is in excess of $65,000 that they would have to repay, plus interest that would be accruing on it.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
That it?
For now.
Can't think of anything else?
Well, I got a note here.
Representative Hawker.
Mr. Chairman, Diane, on page 6 of your handout here, you have a small table there in the right-hand column, and this is the dollars that you've received in dealing with collections on delinquencies through both garnishments and workouts. 98, 99, 2000, 2001, you were running in excess of $20 million a year collected, and in calendar year 2002, that dropped substantially to $14 million. Could you address that, please?
Yes, I can. Representative Harris, Representative Hawker, that's the result of a few different things happening. One, I mentioned earlier that our default rate had dropped substantially, so that means we have more active repayers that the income on their loans wouldn't be reported here. The other thing that has occurred is the dividend has dropped substantially, and that has been a single source of capturing uncollectible debt in the past. So we expect that to potentially continue to decline. It doesn't mean that total revenues are declining similarly, or collections on all loans, but collections on delinquent or defaulted loans would drop.
Follow up?
Just you know, the precipitous decline here, you know, it just seems an unusual relationship. The dividend hasn't, you know, itself declined in proportionate. Is there any other factor that, or have we reached the point where we have you know, essentially mined out the collectability of the delinquent portfolio?
Through the chair, Representative Hawker, I think that's probably a fairly accurate characterization. The number of borrowers that we're keeping from going into default who are in the state has increased substantially. I didn't point out this, provide this statistic, but since we started calculating cohort default rates, we also, in 1996, we also started tracking separately those rates associated with borrowers in the state and those associated with borrowers who are outside of the state. We saw a much higher percentage of default activity of borrowers living in the state, 40% higher in 1996. That had dropped to less than a 5% differential in the 2001 numbers. So by finding other ways for Alaskans to keep control of their financial destiny, or at least the part of it represented by their loan, we've kept them from going the PFD route. So not only is the amount of the dividend dropping, the number of claims that we're making to Department of Revenue have dropped as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Representative Williams.
You mentioned earlier in your 1 in 4 people, students do not go to secondary education. What is a norm throughout the state? And you mentioned something that you were doing something to get them to better understand it.
Mr. Chairman, it's important to understand the statistic. It means that at that point in their life where they would typically go on to college, they're not. And I think that we all know anecdotally that a lot of Alaskan kids go out and just want to see the world, you know, hit the road, basically. But I don't think that accounts for the difference that on average, other states see about 40 to 50% of the college-age kids going into college. And I think that there's an opportunity cost for the individual of not pursuing post-secondary education immediately after secondary school. And whether they go back to train later on, they've still missed out by delaying the benefits to them. What we expect to do is try to educate Alaskans about the importance, the economic importance of going on. Statistically, the two-year associate degree has the earning potential of a high school degree 20 years ago. And so we've shifted. I mean, this is stuff that we all know, but if you're looking at a family where there isn't a history of college going, then how do you create that expectation? How do you start that history from happening? And I think it's lack of information that it's a possibility for them. And so the commission is trying to take a role in both identifying existing programs, because there are outreach programs in pockets of the state, but there's no integration of those programs. There isn't really communication between those programs to identify what is effective in getting kids committed to the idea of post-secondary education and what isn't. And beginning this year, the commission is engaged in finding ways to improve the situation in Alaska.
Is that within your mission statement also?
It is. Thanks to you folks. In 2001, as part of the Alaska Advantage legislation, there was a clarification of the commission's mission, and we are directly authorized and charged to engage in this activity.
Professor Stevens, I mean Representative Stevens.
Thanks, Chairman. As a recipient of this at one time, going back to graduate school, I'm a great fan, and actually I took advantage of it at the time where there was a student loan forgiveness benefit, which has long since vanished. But in fact, I'm sort of surprised you consider that a...
You're advocating for that again?
Yes, for legislators. I know a couple I'd like to send back to school. I guess I've never read your mission statement, and I just have a question, because maybe I misunderstand it. The term lifelong learners, to me that means people of all ages to go back to school, but in fact, you don't do that. You just deal with pretty much recent high school graduates, don't you? Am I misunderstanding what the mission statement says and means?
Through the chair, Representative Stevens, not at all. In fact, one of the pieces, I think our approach is basically this. You're better off helping somebody be prepared at the earliest point in their life to benefit from education. Having said that, there's going to be, even if we're wildly successful, at some point, some folks that we miss, and we need to be prepared moving forward to intersect with them with information at any point during their life. And so the commission, one of the partners that the commission is engaging in this process is the Department of Labor. We want to, in the very near future, have some sort of presence, whether it's in print material or video or web or whatever, in the job centers in Alaska, because those are folks, too, that are just in much need, if not more, of that kind of advice than the 17-year-old is. That is a part of our activities, and I just, rather than take all of your time this afternoon, I didn't go into that level of detail.
Thank you. Follow up, Mr. Chairman. Could you give me just a number of the number of students currently that have outstanding loans or maybe an easier program? And do you have a number for the overall in the history of the agency, how many students you have affected through student loans?
What I can tell you through the chair, Representative Stevens, is that we make about 10,000 loans a year. Of those loans, we make loans to about 10,000 borrowers a year. I would estimate at this point that we have probably 75,000 borrowers, and I will verify these estimates and follow up with you, but about 75,000 borrowers. I don't have a total number of Alaskans that the program has served. I do know that the total loan to Alaskans is well in excess of probably $1.3 billion since the program was first began.
Something to be very proud of. Mr. Chairman, on page 4, I might have misunderstood this. I thought you said $3.6 million was the initial capital contribution. It says here $306 million. Maybe I did misunderstand. Is it $306 million was the initial?
Through the chair, Representative Stevens, it's $306 million was the total assets that were conveyed to the corporation and used to capitalize our initial issuance of debt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was able to visit the Miami program in Anchorage just last summer, and it was very impressive. I encourage anyone to stop by if you can. They always like to show you the gross anatomy lab and then invite you to lunch after they do that. It's a great program, really.
Is that it? Senator Bundy, you have a question? Or
not that could be answered here.
Okay.
Yeah, it's right the water over there.
Yeah, that's right. You became one of them. Are there any more questions for Diane? Representative Foster, you have a question?
No, I don't. Thank you.
All right. Mr. Chairman,
Representative Stoltz?
I also appreciate the forgiveness, but I'm sure glad we're not dealing with a recurring appropriation that would have to be funded to take care of that.
This was all started under different times. Okay, Diane, I appreciate it very much. Your department provides a great service for Alaskans and students and all trying to get a better education, and we'll continue to watch it and see if we can help you in any way we can.
We appreciate your support.
We're going to take a brief recess, and we will... Acting Commissioner Kevin Duffy is here. Welcome, Kevin, back to our wonderful committee. And if you'd like to proceed, we'd like to listen to you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to be here representing Fish and Game today. For the record, again, my name is Kevin Duffy, Acting Commissioner for the Department. With me today on my right is Kevin Brooks. He's our Director of Administrative Services. As you've no doubt heard by now, the administration's working on its FY04 budget request and hopes to have it to you later this month. I'd like to spend just a brief period of your time talking about the programs and structures, basically, of the department today. I'd like to start first with the mission of the department, reminding committee members that it's grounded in the Constitution and statute, and the mission of the department is to protect, maintain, and improve the fish, game, and aquatic plant resources of the state, and to manage their use and development in the best interest of the economy and well-being of the people of the state, consistent with the sustained yield principle. So really, the sustained yield principle is the constitutional reference I mention. The management structure in the department includes one commissioner and two deputy commissioners in the commissioner's office, as well as six division directors. Director of the Division of Commercial Fisheries, I'm sure most of you have met him, Mr. Doug Meekum. Sport Fisheries, Mr. Kelly Hepler. Wildlife Conservation Division, we have a recent change there. Mr. Wayne Reglin had been with the department for approximately 25 years, has decided to move on to the next phase of his life and has retired. And as of today, Matt Robus, the current deputy director, will be in an acting director of wildlife conservation status. For the Division of Habitat and Restoration, a subject matter I'm sure you've heard nothing of lately, we have Ms. Carrie Howard is serving in an acting director capacity there. The Division of Subsistence, Mary Pete, and Administrative Services, Mr. Kevin Brooks to my right. We also have within, underneath the structure of Administrative Services, a Board of Fisheries and Game Executive Director, that is Diana Cody. We also have, tangentially related to the department's responsibilities, the Limited Entry Commission. They have three commissioners appointed by the governor, approved by the legislature. Those three current commissioners are Mr. Bruce Twomley, Mary McDowell, and Marlene Johnson. The current year budget of the department is approximately $135 million from about 10 separate funding sources. The majority of our funding, however, comes from three main sources for fish and game. Approximately $48 million in general fund, that is federal receipts or federal funds, $30 million in general funds, and the remaining $25 million of fish and game funds, that's received from sale of hunting and fishing licenses, that kind of activity. So three major funding sources, federal, $48 million, general fund, a little over $30 million, and fish and game funds, $25 million. Of the department's general fund dollars, it's safe to look at the GF that comes into the department as approximately 80% of that general fund goes into the Division of Commercial Fisheries. We like to consider ourselves a fee-supported program to some degree, and by that I mean both the Division of Sport Fish and Wildlife Conservation are fully funded by non-general fund sources. So Sport Fish Division, Wildlife Conservation Division have no GF, or on Wildlife Conservation's Division, I believe there was about 30,000 last year. So very little GF budget in either of those divisions. The commercial fishing industry, as I said, about 80% of the GF is in commercial fish, is one of the largest employers of the state. I'm sure a lot of you are familiar with that issue, and it makes a significant contribution to the general fund through fisheries business taxes, fishery landing taxes, salmon and seafood marketing assessments, and other means. We as a department look forward to working with the subcommittee that is headed up by Representative Whitaker, who was here earlier, on the details of our FY04 budget once the governor has submitted to the legislature. And as I said, we're hoping that happens fairly soon. Basically, our management philosophy in the department is sustainability. Maximum sustained yield and sustainability of the resources for a variety of users and residents, the priority being subsistence use, and also very important use of the commercial, as that I've already mentioned, and also recreational hunting and fishing. Our management philosophy is really one of getting out to the field, out on the grounds management. My experience is with the Division of Commercial Fisheries extensively, and we really delegate the day-to-day management responsibilities on fisheries, in this case, to area biologists that live out in our remote Alaskan communities. And really up, as you progress up to a headquarters level, we're just, in a way, kind of staff support for the area management biologists, who really are the people who are out on the front line, know the industry, are flying to fisheries, understand catch per unit of effort, and make opening and closing decisions on fisheries on a day-to-day basis. So we're really decentralized in that sense. Statewide, there's approximately 1,800 authorized positions. About half of those positions are full-time, and the other half are part-time seasonal. Typically, in our field season, summer for fisheries, we employ a lot of part-time people and non-permanent people. Similar in the wildlife area, but much more in the fishery side. So 1,800 total, about half of those are part-time seasonal type positions. Basically, our workload doubles during the summer months on an annual basis. As I talked about us having a strong presence out in the field, we have a presence in over 40 locations statewide. We believe this year there are a number of issues that the administration will be working with the legislature on, and we look forward to those opportunities. I think a good example of that may be any legislation, if it comes forward, out of the Joint Legislative Salmon Industry Task Force, just recently released their report to the legislature. We're excited about some of the prospects in there and look forward to dialogue with the legislature representing the administration. We do have some issues we will be dealing with soon and long term, but I'm not going to go into any detail at this point on the issues. I wanted to give a general overview, see if Kevin wants to add anything I may have left out, and then we could open it up for questions, Mr. Chairman.
Hey, Kevin, do you have any?
No, Mr. Chairman, you did a fine job covering the high points there.
Okay, other questions? A number of members here who have a fishing or game interest.
I like to catch fish.
Representative Stoltz.
I just wondered, should we initiate action to rename the Division of Wildlife Conservation Game the Division of Game, or should we wait for the administration?
You want to state that question again, or was that a...
Should we wait a while before initiate any action to rename the Division of Wildlife Conservation back to its appropriate name of game, or should we wait around for a while for any administrative action?
Through the chair, Representative Stoltz, I guess asking my opinion, I would advise that we get a look at the governor's OFAR budget and see how that rolls out and have some more detailed conversations at the subcommittee level and make that determination. Mr. Chair.
Hey, your subcommittee chair has arrived. Representative Stevens.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is the subcommittee chair.
You raised your hand, so usually when you raise your hand, I'll call on you.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Duffy, I just want to ask about the relationship between the department and the North Pacific Council. I know you represent that. Could you talk to us a little bit about what your philosophy is, and will you be continuing in that position, and maybe comment on that?
Through the chair, Representative Stevens, I think there's a bunch of what-if scenarios that haven't played out in terms of the final structure, management structure for Department of Fish and Game at headquarters. As you all know, I'm in an acting commissioner capacity, and there will be a period of time until some decision is made on the commissioner position. And it is not my intent to appoint one or the other of my two deputy commissioners in Fish and Game until such time as a commissioner is formally approved, brought forward from the Board of Game and Board of Fisheries to the governor, and the governor brings it forward for legislative confirmation. It is my intent, if I am commissioner, to remain on the North Pacific Fishery Management Council as the state's representative in the council process. The North Pacific Fishery Management Council, for those not familiar with it, is a body that deals with primarily groundfish fisheries, both in the Bering Sea, Aleutian Islands, and the Gulf of Alaska. We also deal with the crab fisheries in the Bering Sea, Aleutian Islands. And right now, really, in terms of comparing the groundfish fisheries to other fisheries in the state, it's really kind of the big game right now, so to speak. The groundfish fisheries are extremely healthy relative to abundance, and we have a very strong market share relative to overseas exports of different species of groundfish and different product forms. In terms of my philosophy, my philosophy in the council is to ensure that the best interests of the state of Alaska generally, and specifically the coastal communities and the residents of the state of Alaska, benefit to the maximum extent possible through the decision-making process in the council arena. By way of example, we in the council are developing some fishery rationalization programs. Those are usually accompanied by a reduction in number of vessels, as well as changes in a management structure to make the whole paradigm more economically feasible. We have recently come forward as a council with a rationalized program for the Bering Sea crab, for a comprehensive program on Bering Sea crab, which requires some approval from Congress before we can initiate that. As a council, we would like to kind of put that one behind us and monitor how that goes, because the council has a commitment to make sure that there is long-term fairness between the harvest and processing sector in the Bering Sea crab industry. There is a significant buyback program to reduce the fleet under that also. I wouldn't say more importantly, but of extreme importance to Alaska residents is a current program that we're undertaking in the council process, and that is rationalization of our Gulf fisheries in the Gulf of Alaska. And that is where there is even a higher level of participation of Alaskan coastal communities in those fisheries. The Gulf fisheries are fairly complex, with some federal water fisheries on groundfish, as well as some parallel state fisheries for those resources, specifically Pacific cod in the state of Alaska. But the Gulf fisheries and the Gulf rationalization program are extremely important to the residents of Kodiak and other coastal communities in the Gulf. What I am doing as the state representative on the Council for Gulf Fisheries, ensuring, number one, that we have internal coordination at headquarters where I work with our Westward Region staff, which is Kodiak, and then satellite offices in Dutch Harbor. We need to ensure that there is coordination within the department as we move forward on shaping Gulf fisheries. And it is also important that the department work with our constituents to a high degree to make sure that the program that is designed in the end is ultimately in the best interest of Alaska residents. Now, having said that, one has to recognize that the voting structure on the council, there's 11 voting members. In the end, there are 6 votes from the state of Alaska, different constituents, and there's, so out of a total of 11 on any particular issue, in order to go forward, it is always my, my efforts are always focused on getting the number of votes to go forward with policy calls. In most circumstances, I think the state of Alaska is very successful in moving forward with what we think is appropriate fisheries public policy in that arena. Depending on the issue, it's often complex and the negotiations are tough, but just stepping back to my philosophy, I think it's important that I coordinate not only internally in the department, but that our department is very open and gain as much public input as we can as we go through some of these fish rationalization programs. So that might have been a long-winded answer to your question, but it is a significant component of the Alaska economy as well as some of our state-managed fisheries. Representative Stevens, Representative Harris.
Thank you, Chairman. If I follow up, I appreciate your comments, Ms. Duffy. Could you give us a brief description of the test fisheries? I understand how that occurs when the department is underfunded and you have to find a way to fund your research and your efforts, but it just seems to be an odd way to go about a state agency, and maybe you'd comment on that.
Through the Chair, Representative Stevens, yes, the test fish program we currently conduct in different areas of the state is not without its controversy, acknowledged. What we try to do is use the test fish receipts to fund the basic program to assess abundance of the different stocks, crab stocks, salmon, wherever we're at. But what we have done in order to make it more of a transparent process to make sure that we are not using test fisheries to basically run the department is we do have a standard operation procedures manual on how we manage our test fisheries. And we have developed some of these operating procedures just because of previous questions from not only our constituents but through the legislative process. It's not an ideal world, but the test fish program receipt component is a fairly significant part of our operating budget on an annual basis. Maybe Kevin Brooks could provide a little more detail on that. It might be helpful to address your question through the chair.
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Stevens. Test fish has kind of evolved in our budget. You know, it has. I think currently we have about $4 million and receipt authority. We've never come close to actually, you know, generating or collecting that much. But it did start out years back that the department was out on the fishing grounds determining when to open a fishery, say herring fishery in Sitka Sound or something like that. And you're looking for maturity of the roe and the strength of the run, that kind of thing. And so you'd go out there and do some sets and catch some fish and then you'd just sell them on a ticket and use the receipts. Instead of wasting the fish, you'd sell them and use the receipts. Well, over time, it has kind of evolved into a program where through budget reductions and other things that the department and the division specifically has encountered, the test fish receipts has become more of a funding mechanism for the management of the program, where, you know, out in Bristol Bay, it may cost a certain, you're kind of test fishing to an amount instead of just selling fish that have been caught to determine run strength. And so it's grown to where we probably actually realize $2 million or in excess of $2 million a year in test fish receipts, and it has become a, you know, pretty significant portion of our budget. Our general fund budget in Confish is about $25 million, so it's approaching 10% of their general fund that's generating in that test fish receipts, and it is something we try and stay up front with the industry, but it does create some, you know, tension there because we're out there and basically competing with the fleet to you know, generate revenue to manage the buildings.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Stoltz?
Yes, sir, Mr. Chairman. The emergence of the next presenter reminded me of a question. I have a question regarding the Anchorage Coastal Trail, the Tony Nose Coastal Trail. What is the department's official position on it going across the refuge? It seemed that that mixed signals in the past, and there may have been some muzzling. And just, I wonder if there is an official position on the refuge.
Through the chair, Representative Stoltz. I think there was a position of the department during the previous administration, but in all, to give you a direct answer, with the new administration, that is not an issue that I have had a chance to be briefed by the governor or talk with chief of staff to really say that this is the administration's position on this. And I would be reluctant to say what, and I'm not sure what it would be, but I would be reluctant to state what the department's position would be without some clearance from the third floor on what they think about it.
Mr. Chairman, what was the position of the previous administration? So if something evolves, I'll know what happened?
Through the chair, Representative Stoltz, I believe the perspective of the previous position was the orange route, and I don't know exactly what that entails, but I do think that it entailed some presence on the refuge at that time.
Mr. Chairman, the previous administration, you mean the department?
Through the chair, Representative Stoltz, to the extent that the department is part of the administration, in the previous Knowles administration, that was the preferred route.
Mr. Chairman, I don't mean to follow up too long, but I'm not familiar with the routes, but philosophically, going across the refuge, did the department have I guess I'm getting a little confused by mentioning the routes, but I'm just talking about the whole issue of the refuge.
Maybe I could ask the commissioner, acting commissioner, to get you a map of the area showing the proposed difference in routes and the former administration's preferred route, and what the position of the administration, previous administration, which you were a part of, you should have some knowledge of that, what their preference was involving the refuge and whatever else environmental concerns there were.
Thank you. No, thank you, sir. That's it.
We'd be glad to do that, Mr. Chairman, and I will not provide Representative Stoltz unless he wants it with a copy of the environmental impact statement. It's about like that. I'll give you some bullets that summarize where we were at 2 months ago.
I didn't want to speak for Representative Stoltz, but I think that may be what information he needs. And
yes,
that would help probably.
Thank you for directing perhaps a route that was going circuitously and providing that leadership, sir.
Any other questions? He's already getting there. Okay, if there aren't any other questions, I have a couple. I know that you're only the acting commissioner, and has the department come up with a different philosophy? I know it's partly driven by the board's decision, Board of Games decision, on game management.
Mr. Chairman, I love these easy questions at my first meeting of the year. We don't have I think there was a range of philosophies. What we've got in front of us is the game board has a range of tools by which we manage wildlife populations. You're familiar with where the previous administration was, and under the current administration, it's one of those issues that it's too early in the administration to really give you a ironclad, this is the administration's position on particular game management issues. But I suspect that as our 2024 budget rolls out and we have further internal discussions, we'll be actively engaged in those kind of issues, and I will do what I can as commissioner to be crystal clear on those issues.
Fair enough, and I understand. I'm just some topics that I know will come out as we move along. Same question, subsistence. I know the governor in his campaign, as well as in his State of the State, had some comments about trying to do something to resolve the subsistence dilemma we are in the state. Any comments on that?
Representative Harris, or Mr. Chair, my comment on that would be that to the extent that I've talked to the governor on this particular issue, and it's been brief, they are trying to find a subsistence solution. I think it's going to be a high priority for this administration. I think it will be multifaceted, and those particulars are being discussed right now, but they have not rolled out any particular policy on which way they'd like to exactly go on that issue.
Okay, fair enough. With those easy questions, I'll let you off the hook. Any other questions? If not, thank you both very much, and we will look forward to seeing you in front of Representative Whitaker's subcommittee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Take a short break, and we'll come back with the Department of Transportation. Okay, here we are. Did I scare you?
Yeah.
Okay, next and last for the day, we have the DOT dot puff, as we call them. Commissioner Barton, welcome.
Thank you.
And proceed.
Yes, sir.
Let me introduce first some staff I brought along to answer your questions. Mike Downing, who's the state's chief engineer and the director of the Division of Design and Engineering Services. Frank Richards, our state maintenance chief. Captain George Capacci, who is celebrating his 50th birthday today.
Uh-oh. Yeah, one birthday cake already.
No singing, please.
General manager for the Marine Highway System. Dennis Bouchard, who's our legislative liaison and special projects manager, and Nancy Slagle, our director of statewide administrative services. Those folks can answer your questions.
She sings at the church, so she can sing for Captain Capacci.
I think he's already taken care of, Mr. Chair.
Well.
What we'd like to talk about today is the department overview that you all requested, and we'll specifically focus on operations and those particular items in our operations. Your Department of Transportation is divided up into three geographic areas, the northern region, which is headquartered in Fairbanks, the central region headquartered in Anchorage, and the southeast region headquartered in Juneau. And each of those regions has a regional director. Ralph Forthout in Fairbanks, and Bob Dahl in southeast, and Dave Eberle in central region in Anchorage. I encourage them to provide you any information that you're interested in. We have 84 maintenance stations scattered across the state from Barrow to Ketchikan. The National Highway System, approximately 2,100 centerline miles of National Highway System road. The Alaska Highway System, these are roads not of national significance but of statewide significance. There's about 1,440 miles of those. And we've got 37 more miles currently proposed. We operate 261 airports, including the two international airports at Fairbanks and Anchorage. And we have 21 rural certificated airports, and the remainder are community airports. There are 73 state-owned ports and harbors, 51 operated by agreement. Operated by local government under agreements. And we have the Marine Highway System with 33 ports of call and a route of approximately 3,500 miles. The governor recently reorganized the department into a modal organization. We have the left-hand leg is the highway side of things, and those functions under the highway side also provide services to the two remaining columns up there, in other words, to aviation and to the marine highway. That is, the engineering services, for example, services all of the other two functions as well as highways, as does Nancy's group and the planning group and so forth. Created two advisory boards. One is an aviation advisory board, and the other is a marine transportation advisory board. And we're just in the process of getting that all implemented and underway. The functions down in the at the working level, so that has yet to be worked through. But we want to approach that in a deliberate manner and very carefully and with a lot of common sense. Because the people out in the regions, some of them are in, the maintenance people, for example, are involved in airports, highways, and in some cases, ferry terminals. Historically, you can see what's happened to the construction program over the past several years here. And it's generally trending up. And we, of course, have the two bond programs as well that the voters passed last fall. On the other hand, our operating budget shows the opposite trend, and trending downward for the last several years, and when you adjust it with the CPI, it is an even steeper decline. So we're building assets and having less money to maintain them. The operating budget by fund source, you can see here a variety of sources that provide monies for the operating budget. That's a total of about a little over $350 million. And the general fund portion of that, receipt and receipt supported services, you can see where the expenditures are, and I would particularly like to point out the M&O expenditure, which is the large orange part of that chart, and that's the money that is used to maintain roads and maintain the rural airports. And that total amounts to about 102 million, or that total amounts to about 87 million. The total GF and receipts is 102 million. Which is a little more than a quarter of the M&O is a little more than a quarter of the operating budget. The maintenance funding by region, again, central being headquartered in Anchorage, northern headquartered in Fairbanks, and southeast headquartered here, is displayed in this particular slide. There's a lot of reasons for disparities between regions, miles of road being an obvious one. Type of road surface, whether it's paved or gravel, and obviously weather conditions have a big influence on the investments that are made in maintenance around the state. In 2003, previous administration incurred a operations budget cut, which forced some reduction in the maintenance of the state's facilities. We closed we closed stations, maintenance stations in the Nilchik, Chittenden, and Birch Lake. We reduced the amount of maintenance on the rest of the road system. We closed a couple airports that were on the road system. This had an impact, obviously, on the citizens of this state. But beyond that, it also potentially impacted federal funding, particularly in relation to the airports. It's pretty clear that when the federal government invests money in there, one of the grant assurances is that we maintain it. And the other potential risk was a reduction, a penalty, if you will, on federal funds, essentially using the same logic. Governor Murkowski recognized the risks and the impacts on the folks of this state and directed that we restore the maintenance, the winter maintenance, to the 02 maintenance level. And that you can see there what was actually done to do that.
Mike, before you go on, I just want to ask a question here while I have it. In the request for supplemental funding in the restoration of those maintenance stations, was Birch Lake opened again?
Yes, you'll see that on the next slide. We did reopen all three maintenance stations. We reopened Squintna and Clear Airport and restored the maintenance on the buildings necessary to support maintenance activities. Moving along, if you recall, in the fall of 2002, we had some opportunities as a result of floods and earthquakes, and you can see some of the damage in the slides up here that was done. We had the October floods on the Kenai, we had the November quake, and then we had more floods in November on the Kenai. And we were glad to see the fall done with. The governor, as well as the president, declared the disaster area, which opened the door for emergency funding for us. And you can see here the impacts of the floods and the amount of money that's necessary to reconstruct and restore that. Now, we're still developing that. This is still a work in process. But some of this is going to require general fund match. Some of it requires no match. The early FEMA money, we don't have to match. One of the unfortunate aspects of this, there were a number of unfortunate aspects, but the had we gotten the necessary permits to place the riprap that our design people thought was needed, there probably would have been a lot less damage.
What was the delay in the permits?
Well, we...
Habitat Division?
Simply put, yes.
Okay.
The earthquake impacts. The worst of it was on the Tok cutoff, and the worst airport damage was at Northway. We repaired both of those facilities to get them through the winter, so we could get into the construction season. But here you can see the amount of money that's going to be necessary to restore those facilities. And again, this is an ongoing effort, and we're still identifying problems that need to be addressed. There's about $600 million in emergency funds available nationwide, and we're looking for 60 of those. Congress historically has appropriated about $100 million, so we don't know yet how much we'll get. Let me discuss the airports. We're the largest airport operator in the country with 261 of them. We expect this new organizational structure to provide renewed leadership and better customer relations with the users and the community. We have the Alaska.
Mike, can you hold on for just a second? Representative Stoltz has a question.
Just a real quick one, Mr. Chairman. Which of the airports are net revenue producers, both rural and
Anchorage is a profitable airport. I'll get into the linkage of Anchorage and Fairbanks shortly. I don't believe we make any money anywhere else, do we, Frank? Birchwood,
okay.
How about that?
That be in your district?
You're here.
By coincidence.
Amazing.
But this, you know, the importance, despite the fact that most of these don't make money, they do provide a very essential basic service to Alaskans. There are many communities, as you well know, in this state that is virtually the only access. The Alaska International Airport System is the linkage for Anchorage and Fairbanks. The financial arrangement there includes both of those as a single entity, essentially. And despite operating them separately, the financing is all interwoven between the two. And Anchorage does make a lot of money. I probably shouldn't have said that. Are there any air carriers here? But
well, they've been to see us, don't worry.
I'm sure they have. But at any rate, Anchorage helps the revenue situation at Fairbanks, I guess is the best way to say that. And if we separated those two financially, there'd be a very different picture.
We love Fairbanks here, too, so.
Good. Ted Stevens, Anchorage International, is now the number one cargo airport in the United States and, I believe, in North America. We have, of course, the busiest float plane base in the world there. It is a huge economic engine for Alaska and particularly the Anchorage area, as you can see by these numbers here. and it serves about 5 million passengers a year, and there's 58 airlines that operate at that airport. Many of them are purely cargo and contribute substantially in fuel flowage fees and landing fees. The Fairbanks Airport is the 13th largest cargo airport in the U.S. And we recently expanded the float plane base there. It has an important economic impact in the Fairbanks area. We have just short of 1 million passengers a year there, and there's 15 airlines that operate at Fairbanks. A little bit about the nitty-gritty of how we get projects out on the streets. Our design and engineering services division, which Mike Downing is in charge of, does the basic design work. We'll get a project from that's been through the planning process, and I'd be delighted to talk about the STIP at some later date if you want to do that. But at any rate, those projects come out of the STIP, go into planning, and all the planning design work is done, the projects are prepared for bid, and a lot of other analytical work goes on in Mike's division. The actual construction is the responsibility of the various regions, and they provide the oversight. We have four basic functions within the construction activity: the actual construction and the contracting, project control and necessary facilities, quality assurance, actual contract administration. The construction program in 03, you can see here by mode how many projects we've got underway. These are active contracts and the capital investments that are associated with them. Yeah, I would note that the Anchorage Airport number does not include the terminal project. The Alaska Marine Highway System, of which Captain Capaci, 50 years old, is the general manager.
Still got dark hair.
Celebrated its 40th anniversary on January 23rd.
Congratulations.
Big day. And again, 3,500 nautical miles, 320,000 passengers, and 94,000 vehicles. And I was a little concerned because in some of the national cast-ups, we get compared to the New York ferry system and so forth. So our number of passengers look kind of puny when you get 23 or 24 million out of New York. So I asked George to work up passenger miles, and that looks a lot better. I hope we can use that when we get into discussions at the national level. The Marine Highway route was declared a national scenic byway in 2002, and that comes with that designation and some advantages to the state, not the least of which is we're eligible then for marketing grants. And there's a lot of national promotions about the scenic byway program that I think benefits the tourist industry. Another item of note on that slide is the bottom bullet, and that is that 68% of the cost of the Marine Highway is in labor, which brings me to the fast ferries. We have two fast ferries currently under construction. One will be home ported in Cordova and one in Sitka. And those will be online, the first one about a year from now and the second one in the spring of 05. Those will be a completely different animal. Those will be operated like an airline. They'll go and come, the crews will be home at night. There will be no onboard engineering, no onboard galleys. The food will be essentially similar to an airline meal. And instead of a crew of 50 or 60, it'd take a crew of maybe 10. But we expect those labor costs, or that labor, the labor costs and the percentage of the operation that labor constitutes, to come down over time, particularly when we begin to be able to replace some of the mainliners. Mainliners, some of them are 40 years old. They're going to require $40 million a pop sometime in the next, between now and 2010, I think it is, to meet what's known as SOLAS requirements, safety of life at sea. And at that point, we will have put $40 million into a 50-year-old piece of iron. And that's those two things, I think, are what motivated this development of this fast ferry concept. The what you will see, that should reduce the need for general fund subsidy for the ferry system in the long haul. But in the short haul, you'll see an increase until we begin to retire those mainliners. And as those get retired, then the need for the general fund subsidy will decline.
Mike, can you tell us, you have two of these fast ferry classification on the way. When you go to replace these 40-plus-year-old ships that you have, are you going to replace them again with more fast ferries? Or are you going to look at more conventional ships to replace some of the smaller ones, perhaps?
We currently have options on two more fast ferries, which we need to decide whether we're going to exercise or not. But the idea would be to leave how many mainliners? One new mainliner and...
Captain Kapasch, you want to come up and...
Certainly, Mr. Chairman. Our strategic plan, Mr. Chairman, calls for a future fleet mix of marine highway system vessels, of some conventional vessels, long-haul, deep-draft, monohulls, with a system of fast ferries, catamarans, and even in the future passenger-only ferries to interconnect. So it won't be one or the other. It'll be a mix of both. I think our current strategic plan for 2020 talks about five mainline vessels, conventional vessels, and a fleet of roughly five to six catamaran vessels and some passenger-only ferries in there, and some smaller vessels like the vessel we're designing for.